How's it going, Grass?
Hey!
All right. I'm a little bit nervous. There's a lot of people in here. Now bear with me. Rabbi Howard received the Ernest J. Gaines Award for Literary Excellence in 2008 for the novel Like Trees, Walking, a fictionalized account of a true story, the 1981 lynching of a black teenager in Mobile, Alabama. Howard was a finalist for both the Hemingway Foundation Pen Award and the Hurston Wright Legacy Award for debut fiction in 2008. His latest novel, Driving the King, 2015, explores race and class in 1950s America, witnessed through the experiences of Nat King Cole and his driver, Nat Reardon. And early praise for the novel goes as follows. By following Howard's characters, we are allowed a sidelong but penetrating glimpse into one of the most important events in American history. Howard bends history, proving that the past can be best felt through refracted light rather than under the harsh glare of historical fact. This is from the Minneapolis Star Tribune. So, in cogitating on this, and the novel itself as an expression, and a single expression continued to reverberate in my mind. You had to be there. That vernacular bit of wisdom bespeaks the importance of experience as a way of knowing. That to really get it, we need to have had the full sense of context, of the embodiment of all the myriad and sundry little details that compose the essence of what went down. You had to be there. But for so many of us Americans living in these early days of the third millennium, or perhaps in the darkest timeline, some of the biggest events in our history have been occluded by the weight of their own mythologies, to the point where we remember the events of some 30, 40, 50, 60 years ago as though they were manifestations of classical heroes, rather than the experiences of the quotidian masses just like us, just perhaps even for those of us who were there. So I sat down with Robbie Howard's novel, Driving the King, with, and I'm gonna be real candid here, no idea what to expect. Literally just picked this book up from Midtown Reader like yesterday. It's awesome. You should totally buy it. I think I remember initially when I was sitting down with it, I think I remember hearing that it did have something to do with Nat King Cole, but beyond that, I was jumping in pretty much blind with my eyes closed. I was pleasantly surprised, though, to learn that the novel follows the experiences of Cole's friend, Nat Weary, pretty average black man looking to propose to his girlfriend. This focus is not on black icons, but on the black everyman. And I thought that this was really kind of cool. Black millennial that I am, I can also admit to having grown up with the legends of the social milieu of the movement, in capital letters, and a sense that everything then was so much larger than life, so much grander than the day-to-day of the here and now. But Rabbi's novel yanking me forcibly back in time, so forcibly back in time that I almost got whiplash. One moment I'm in my 2017 home trying to avoid feeling like civilization is about to collapse on a day-to-day instance. The next, Rabbi has me back in the blistering roads of Montgomery, Alabama, circa 1950. The more things change, right? The experience is jarring, if not altogether unfamiliar. Rabbi's prose is so meticulous in its detail, from the mechanic's eye view for the mid-century automotive grill work to the implicitly insidiousness of the calculated neglect of such elements as a colored entrance. As you read his words, you become inextricably bound in the world he forces you to remember in excruciating detail. The past is absolutely not past in these pages. It lurks behind, stands athwart, looms overhead, and is the very ground upon which you stand. You had to be there. But beyond the vicariousness of Rabbi's work with the past and his all-encompassing approach, there is not a picture painted of unrelenting bleakness. His characters are like us in that they are human, and they have very human outlooks, particularly in regards to the future. The mechanisms of oppression that Rabbi writes about would seem unendurable if only we didn't see people doing exactly that, enduring. There is a weariness about them, perhaps the character's name is Matt Weary, right? So there is a weariness about them, but long-suffering peoples, though they are, they continue to persist. All right, so real quickly, and you know, I'm getting my black preacher wrong, right? So y'all bear with me, because I've been meaning really quickly. I just wanted to throw in a quick little anecdote, just to speak personally about Rabbi and about how I know him, both as a professor and as a mentor. Rabbi Howard is amazing because, much the same way that his characters endure, much the same way that his characters seem to have been possessed of a kind of hope in spite of, Rabbi gives me hope. To be a black man in academia is something of an exercise in practical cryptozoology. Like for real, if you see so few brothers around here, you start to wonder if you exist.
Yeah.
Right. Are you like a unicorn or a Sasquatch or something like that? Right? Rabbi is an inspiration for me because he's who I want to be when I grow up. A charismatic, dynamic writer of meaningful fiction that does not at all shy away from its engagement with the past and all of its implications. Rabbi has been an advocate and a mentor on my behalf and has encouraged me to write my own story because it's one worth telling, even if it is about blackness, anime, and nerd shit. He's a good listener, and you know, maybe he's also a saint, who knows.
Yeah.
Friends and colleagues, the English department's Jerome Stern Distinguished Writing Series, and I are proud to introduce Rabbi Howard.
Alex, I appreciate the introduction. Pleasure to work with you, pleasure to be here. I generally, at the readings, I will kind of come in and kind of stand at the back, so this is the first time I've seen the room from up here, so it's kind of new and familiar, so I'm just happy to be able to share a little bit of new work. When I was working on Driving the King and writing about Nat Cole, I kind of needed a counterbalance and more contemporary space, so I ended up listening to a lot of the Commodores, so I was listening to more contemporary music, so that kind of, in a lot of ways, influenced something, some of the pieces that I'm going to read tonight. A little bit of background, these are two pieces from two stories, but I wanted to weave them together. One is from a book that's it was kind of ekphrastic fiction writing, and it is loosely based on pictures that were given to a group of writers, poets, and essayists. But part of that story took place in a town called Blakely. Blakely, Alabama is famous because it was the site of one of the last wars of the last battles of the Civil War. It was also important because quite a time, a little bit later, there was a quarantine because of an outbreak, and now it's kind of a deserted space. So I wanted to kind of reanimate it, repopulate it. And I have two stories that kind of take place there. I'm thinking about how that town, how that place, kind of imagined space is going to run through a few of the things that I'm reading tonight. So, the first one is Welcome to Blakely. The old man is flying. I saw that line over and over in the archived field journals. I went through the books to find out about his evening flights, about those times that he flew out here over my field. And what I found was this, that on three occasions, the fall of 1938, the old man got in his glider and flew over and around the field on the western edge of my farm, between the railroad spur and the tree line. It was the longest of his flights to that point, 9 minutes and 37 seconds. Field notes were marked by two writers, different scripts, two colors of ink. The second set in the old man's cursive, when he landed and filled in notes on his observations, all seen from an angle most would never reach. Ledger after ledger told the same story. Every few weeks during the semester, Dr. Carver and the student proctors loaded up the truck, the movable school with the letters on all sides spelled out, and they set out on these co-op lessons, all things related to the soil. The glider they kept tied on top of the harvester until the lessons were over. And they took folks in, day laborers and tenant farmers, who were too tired to listen, but curious just the same. The learning was never more than 30 minutes, because there was no more valuable time than the hours of people who didn't have much. Honoring this, Dr. Carver's itinerary was precise. He wrapped his talk about peanuts and sweet potatoes, crop rotation, vine splicing, cover foliage, boll weevil eradication, useful and technical advice. When all that was done, the people stayed for the show by the barnstorming professor who had come 300 miles south from Tuskegee, and at his age and frailty, might not be back again. He rated each flight location, and Blakely County was by every measure his favorite launching place. Good winds from the limestone bluffs on the north end of Mobile Bay, and a fast runway. A private railroad spur laid down by the lumber family who owned the place. Tracks barely used after the Depression, most times just a shortcut for the tenant farmers who lived on the property, my people included, going to and from the houses to work, going to and from their houses to work. No train cars to speak of, but they rode instead on the bootleg jitneys, railroad hand cars that moved under the power of whoever held the handles, their muscle and their back. The prophets had pulled together a hand car and two flatbed railroad wagons that together were long enough to carry the glider and to get the old man airborne. The proctors unhooked the wings from the harvester roof and brought down the narrow body, no bigger than a birch canoe, just a quarter of the wingspan. And as Dr. Carver filled the questions, the proctors bolted body to wings, a lattice of birch wood wrapped in sailcloth hardened with flash cotton. He allowed anyone gathered to touch it, use their fingers to take the mystery out of it. Dr. Carver was an artist, watercolors mostly, and no stranger to stretching canvas. And the wings looked painted on, but the streaks of color came from the flash cotton that smelled like honeysuckle but burned like kerosene, a spark away from igniting, but a chance of a chemical fire in mid-flight was slim. But Dr. Carver and the proctors were careful about the landing. To be safe, they covered the metal bolts with beeswax, because if he landed in rocky soil, heaven forbid, a bit of flint rock could spark against the washer, and then he was kindling, and the lessons were all for nothing, because no one would remember anything but his burning. And Dr. Carver did not mention the danger to the people watching. It wasn't in his nature to do so. To know the history he never talked about was to know that Dr. Carver, enslaved in childhood, maimed, had lived through worse than a death of fire and freefall. And with the wings in place, Dr. Carver invited volunteers to help lift his aeroglider onto the rail car. This moment, noted by a student of sociology in her studies on the expectations of the rural Negro, noted a couple of things. One, many have never been asked to volunteer for anything, always drafted, unless it was some hustler selling snake oil or wolf tickets. And number two, that, quote, the vast majority were surprised by the lightness of the plane, their bodies accustomed to the worst kind of weight in their toiling, unquote. The lighter, the better, he told them. And they would then see some upside in his frailty. Physics, he said, was the science of gumption, a lever using something light to move something heavy. And while the children climbed on the railroad jitney, he explained how the seesaw of the lever gave him speed enough to fly before the cars reached the end of the field. He talked about lift, thrust, drag, and weight. The old man had designed slip knots needed for a good takeoff. If the glider slid to the front or side too early, they would tighten to stop its tumbling. But with a little air beneath the glider and the liftoff, the same knots slid loose, and seconds later, he was above them. And after a count of 10, the proctor would pull the handbrake so the sparks that went flying would fall short of his wings. The last thing before he left the ground was this. One of the proctors, perched on the edge of the flatbed, would hand him his guitar, the same one that would later go on the wall of his museum. Although he rode a glider fueled by the strength of children, steered with his feet and his leaning, why would a man play a guitar and not keep his hands on a wheel or handle? The short answer was bats, sometimes birds, to give them fair warning to go around him and not hit his wings with enough speed to rip them open. The second answer was because, why not? It was too late to be scared and timid. He was already up there. The sound of his playing was designed to keep the show going, a human diagram to illustrate the ease of it. This from my childhood primer and not his ledgers. That he put himself through school giving music lessons, using a guitar to fund his science. So in addition to the sweet potatoes and the peanuts, He developed a widely mimicked style of E chords and five note arrangements, introduced into the Alabama Delta what he had brought with him, Iowa folk songs, Missouri serenades, and the Piedmont sound. The old man was flying again. My parents told me that before I read it in the ledgers, and sometimes my mother said it to my father, or vice versa. They didn't remember who said it to whom, but it was said when they were sitting on the porch together, courting. They remembered his chord changes, and a couple more they remembered at their wedding, in a club in Pascagoula, in a Mobile Jamboree, and they played the chords for me, and I played them back until I had them down cold. And when I started a band, I would do my bit of flying. And I was borrowing the doctor's ear and trying to make it mine. And I can say with modesty and objectivity, I can say modestly and objectively that my band was the best in Blakely, small county in the state, but still the best band there. So when I got to college, I was still playing the very best of Dr. Carver's Airborne Serenades. But so too was the lead of this other band, Lionel Richie, Tuskegee-born, who grew up in a house near Dr. Carver's testing grounds, and the railroad spur that brought the college kids from Opelika to the campus. So the test flights that had given his folks the same chords that my people had gave me, and dare I say it, he played them better than me, but no wonder. And he invited me to join the Commodores, not a founding member, but for 14 months I was in the band, up until we were in the room in Motown in Los Angeles, when Berry Gordy wanted a good look at us before he signed. I was the seventh in the band, and he said six is more than enough. But I'm the hype man, I'm told. Motown doesn't need a hype man, he told me. Motown is a hype man. I'm a hype man. And he raised his arms and invited me to look around at his fine home in the hills, platinum records on the wall. And I was on the verge of saying something that I would surely regret. But then Berry Gordy pointed to my notebook, and Lionel nodded. They've been talking, but your songs, though. So things were on the verge of turning bad, and then they turned right back around. And why not? I could write for them better than I could write for myself, because who was I? What was my name? My name was whoever was singing and whoever was paying. My name mattered on the royalty checks only. And when I made what could objectively be called a fortune, I remember the founding father of my signature sound, Dr. Carver, who, though no book or historian will back me in this claim, was a Commodore Emeritus. And to honor that, the first thing I bought was his guitar from a collector. And before I donated it to a museum, I played it for Naomi twice, once on our first date and on our first anniversary. When we moved back to Alabama, we bought the old Blakely place, the main house too far gone to save, for which I was quietly thankful. The realtor said that the potential buyers didn't know what to make of the rest of it. A railroad spur leading up to the place, the turntable, and the quarter moon roundhouse, the one-time station house, all made of limestone and redwood. With all of that standing and sound, we were content to knock down the house and forget it was ever there. The realtor asked about our must-haves. Naomi wanted to see the sky without the bleed of streetlight. She'd been spoiled, she liked to say, after seeing all of it from the window of Atlantis. As small as the windows were in the space shuttle, she saw the world and then some. And before we ponied up the cash, we already knew what photographs would go where. The wall across from the picture window was perfect for the shots she brought back from orbit. Earth over Naomi's shoulder, her up there, weightless and unburdened. The realtor asked what I was going to do with the rail cars in the roundhouse and the mini diesel, and I said I'd just hold on to them until I figured something out. A couple of the Blakely children had tried to revive the place, had bought some sleeping cars, and they were going to make a B&B, which sounded to me like a horrible idea, having strangers in your house day in and day out. But they were beautiful, these cars. Inconvenient, but not urgently so. So I told the realtor, I leave them there. So like I told her, we figured something out. They did make the place feel authentic in its utility, and the first night especially. We popped the champagne that we'd been saving, set our lounge chairs on the turntable and let it go round and round, playing Spin the Bottle with the Starlight, looking up, and that was how the sky was intended to look. But now, the sky is just a mess. The edge of the field is not ours anymore. The notice of eminent domain told the particulars that the state would claim a wide swatch of land clear through Blakely. The Beach Express toll that would cut travel time to the Gulf by an hour, a boon to the local economy, an emergency route for hurricanes, so the public service alone made it impossible to stop. Letters and town hall meetings, yes, we did that, but still, we knew we didn't have a shot. The field is not only in the ledgers, and the stories and any pictures we have, because it is no longer a field. And the train tracks that cut across here, miles from the nearest road, those train tracks are now a railroad crossing of the new toll plaza. We could have dealt with the traffic, but not the lights. They've been testing them on and off for weeks, bright enough to muddle the sky and turn it into the color of a drugstore parking lot. And that's what we see through the picture window, like we're face down in the parking lot at Walgreens. Naomi's down in Cocoa Beach this weekend. It's Memorial Day. And at the Space Center, it's a big time. And the visitors will pack the room to hear her speak, see her slideshow. And she will tell them about the stars she knows by name, the ones we miss with the new light. Today is the grand opening, and it's set for noon. And I've been watching them down there at the Toll Plaza, gathering for the ribbon cutting. The governor, the county commissioners, the Port Authority, Alabama Department of Transportation, the Tourism Council, various dignitaries, and behind them, the first 200 cars who will get through the toll plaza for free and save $2. And another 200 or so lined up and enjoying the fair, face painting and balloons, like a sad, sad Mardi Gras. I watched them from the cab of my diesel engine. And after the realtor asked me what I had planned for the rail cars, and I didn't know then, but I came up with something, an epiphany. I thought of Dr. Carver and his movable school and the wish list in one of the final ledgers that I found in the archive, that he had too much inventory for the harvester, too much for one little truck, and the next logical step was a train car. So I made it so with one of the passenger cars. I paid good money and then some to get it gleaming again, a new paint job and lettering on the side. But that's not the train car that's blocking the toll road, because that one will be damaged when they figure out how to move it. This train has another message painted on the side. Welcome to Blakely. After the ribbon cutting, the governor and dignitaries were meant to lead the charge, followed by the throngs of beachgoers going down toward the Gulf. But now the sheriff is walking across the field in his good shoes. He came for ceremony, but I did not. I have created for him and gathered a considerable problem. And to clear the road, they have to cut the bolts on the wheel blocks. And there were several half a mile down the track as well. And then they need an engine to tow the car somewhere. It would take hours, maybe well into the evening. I had taken more conventional means to address my grievances, but nobody was listening, so I had to ruin some weekend plans. And why now? I had learned what Barry Gordy and Lionel Richie knew, and what Naomi knew during her star talks, and what Dr. Carver knew when the folks gathered around him to learn about the dust. What the Greeks knew when they hid in a horse on the outskirts of Troy, and what anybody who played possum knew, leaning against the ropes and waiting to let loose a good hook they'll remember, which was written above the water cooler in Motown. But a caveat, a spectacle can be an art form, but once you get their attention, you have to hold on to it and decide on a finish that fits what you started. And I will admit that I don't know what that is just yet. So I think of it. As I pop the brake and drive the engine back to the roundhouse, I get a text from Lionel Richie. Apparently the train has made the rounds online. I'm on CNN. He sends an emoticon I've never seen, hands outstretched, not quite a shrug, asking for an explanation. I answer in words, I'm getting the band back together, are you in? When, he asks, tomorrow, sundown. He sends another emoticon, a high sign, and there it is, history in the making. Then I text Naomi, the creek has risen, but for how long? She won't get that text because her phone is off, and she's in front of the Astronaut Experience Auditorium, showing the tourists the slides and the videos and the pictures, evidence of 11 days in orbit, 175 times around the world. And she tells them this, that Houston lets the astronauts pick the music they wake up to, and she requested the song that I had made for just that occasion. One that has only been played in our home and in the space. And I'm playing it now, a fight song that is chock full of love and gumption. I listen while I park on the turntable and give myself a spin, going around one good time, reveling in this small first victory and thinking about what comes next. So the second piece kind of takes place in the same town. This is in the same town that happens roughly 100 years before, maybe, I have to figure the math out, but this is from a story called, about 6 pages from Eventide, sections of it. A half mile ahead of us on the old turn road, a motorcycle kept straight when it should have gone right, and the headlights swerved into the darkness through the salt marsh and toward the bay. When the bike hit, I couldn't tell, but the headlight went sideways and into a rise of sand. I listened for hollering, hoping for it, because at least then I know the driver was still alive. I didn't see anybody in the wash of the headlight. All it showed was the trash that collected in the grass. Prohibition had turned bottles into contraband, but Dead Horse Bay was not a drinking beach like Coney Island or Rockaway. This was a place to toss out bottles, so the glass, some broken already and the rest soon to be, left a thrown rider with no merciful place to fall. I stopped the truck where the road was wide enough. My daughter slept under a blanket. Somebody's in the water, I told her. You wait. She stood up and got a little closer to the windshield. But still, there was nobody up walking around and not a sound. I ran over to the motorcycle and lifted it quickly, hoping to get the weight off the man. But what it rested on was a dune, man-made, a railroad tie with a hill of blown sand. The top edge had been sifted by the spokes of the white wall tires, and there was no one underneath, and I saw the rider sitting a few yards away on a stack of railroad ties that kept the sand from the road. Only one of the slaughterhouses still stood, and instead of dead horses, it was filled with broke-down carriages, and what remained of the horses was in the sand. The smooth bits of white on the shore looked as much like coral as they did bone. Hermit crabs had made houses of hollow pieces of sperm. The rider thanked us and said he was fine, but his claim of being fine was untested. He put weight on his feet and doubled over, favoring his right leg. He eased back down then, leaning back and stretching his leg out, and I saw the problem. Whatever made that hole in the bottom of his shoe was still stuck in his foot. He tried to cross his legs to get a look at it, but the movement set off the pain in him. No telling what it was. Sometimes the surf had enough mercy to bury the trash, but sometimes a rusted bit of metal took a razor's edge. And sometimes the bones broke to slivers. Since the city started draining the marsh, the splintered pieces sat upright and ready to cut somebody. I called for Clara, but she was already in the back of the truck I drove for Dr. Weston. She had purchased a harvester and made it into a four-wheel clinic, treating fish pickers and farmhands, and she let Clara help with the bandages and the light cleaning of wounds. Clara had two hand lanterns lit and spread out in a few of the blankets my wife had sewn. I helped the man to the payload, and he watched Clara as she cleaned the pliers. There was gratitude in his face, but a little worried too. A teenager ready to dig into his foot. I pulled the fish hook out of my daddy's forearm when I was 10, she told me. She asked him where he was from, got him talking about back home, Choptank River in Cambridge, Maryland. And that was a trick she learned from Dr. Weston. Let the talking work like ether. Take his mind someplace else before she put the pliers into his foot. And a quick winch was all that Samuel needed to feel as a quick winch was all that Samuel seemed to feel as she freed what it cut into him. Horse bone, maybe whale. Claire placed the bone beside her and pressed a cloth into his foot. He jumped a bit with the chill of peroxide while Claire cleaned the wound. I examined his shoe, bending it back and forth, and I told him his shoes were finished. And by then he was looking at my boots, the ones that could cross broken glass or bone without a bit of worry. He asked where I got them, and I said I took them off the feet of a man who almost drowned, and there was no use in lying, so I said it because it was true. There was no reason to be sorry, because all I was doing that night was minding my line, and a man, Bo Charles, familiar to anyone in that stretch of Blakely, told me I owed him money. The bridge is incorporated. It's the town of Blakely now. You need a license, he told me. The city ends at the road, and the bridge is the bridge, no place else. It's incorporated now. You know what that means? Yeah, it means you weren't what's in my pocket. And both Charles had two men with him, who were something close to deputies. They were the shadows behind him. He was standing in the middle of the bridge with a narrow flask light glowing in his pocket. It was something the revelers had started to bring in the new year, and they also wore them during Mardi Gras. And I heard they carried them in their tailcoat pockets, making their masks and their bow ties glow while they marched down Canal Street. And the light that Bo Charles carried showed his game warden badge, no bigger than the doubloon he might have thrown in the Mardi Gras parade. He got himself elected or chosen in a city his family nearly owned. You got to pay a fine, he told me, fishing without a license. He pulled a book out of his pocket and wrote down my name. He knew it without asking. His people owned three commissaries in Blakely, and they shorted us on everything we bought, but went heavy on what we owed. So I came to the water for a reason, to eat something I wouldn't spend weeks paying off. All I owed was the patience to wait for a fish. If I had a nickel for a fish, I'd go to the pier and buy a snapper, I told him. No money in your pocket is another form of vagrancy. He wrote it in his book a little bit more, and then he stared like I owed him more talk on top of money. My float barge. And what I might eat that evening was hooked, liable to tangle my line on a low branch and break free. You wrote my name in your book, Bo Charles. I'll settle. Now leave me alone. The men behind the game warden didn't look like his friends, but they were on his payroll and would be on me if I fought. So I thought better of it. I turned, sat on the top railing. I let my feet on the second and listened to the hush of the water broken by that fish. A big one, it seemed, down there testing my line. If I lose this fish, then I don't have to pay. You can clear my name. I figured he had a pistol under his jacket. And if not, his men did indeed. And if they moved, I'd fall back into the water, swim through the dark, and hide. I could check my line when they moved on. But Bo Charles wouldn't do a thing but put another mark in his book, like his mother did at the commissary, making folks pay for any crossword or stare with more interest. A thumb on the scale. You're still on my bridge. I lifted my feet straight out. My ass is on the bridge, but not my feet. What's to find now? I waited for him to reach under his coat, but he didn't. He came on me quick with two hands on my collar. I grabbed him in kind, took the knuckles of one hand and the wrist of the other, and I lifted with everything I had. I got a good look at the brand new boots on his feet as I kicked his legs out from under him. He fell back over the railing, carrying both of us down those 10 feet into the creek. The flask light showed every bit of terror on his face, and when we fell headfirst into the creek, the seal around the bulb held for a few seconds and then flickered and left us in the dark. If he held me, he could have drowned me easy. I could have done the same. Instead, I broke loose and swam into the flooded branches of a cypress tree and hid while Bo Charles turned around looking for me, the tail end of his air bubbling out of him. He stopped spinning and looked up. And as set as he was on finding me, he wanted that next breath a little bit more. So he followed his bubbles, and I swam behind. And when he was close enough to touch the surface, I grabbed his boot. His fingers broke through the surface and could feel the breeze. But that seemed to bring on panic, his hands feeling air that he couldn't really breathe yet. He looked down and saw me, his face was a question. I answered him with a turn of his boot heel and shook it, enough for that foot to come loose and for him to rise to the surface. And while he was gasping, I grabbed the other foot, because half a pair of $10 boots wasn't worth a dime until you had both of them. Once I swam through the creek, I left home, and I left my name back there, too, in case Bo Charles sent people looking for me. I would be somebody else. Besides, I had the same last name as he, and it would cost me more than it ever got me. A county full of namesakes and barely any kin. And when I married Augusta, I changed my name to hers. And who I was, who I would be, started over. My boots kept me dry and sure-footed, warm in the New York winters, and any bit of dust or scrape I polished while sitting on our front steps, using the polish I made, beeswax and olive oil. I added a little color when it was called for, squid ink or ox blood. And for Christmas, Augusta bought some from a store in Brooklyn. The colors had names, autumn maple, moonlight gray, eventide. Names are funny because of what they tell us, what they tell you to see on your fingertips as you rub it around and hot all the scrapes and the wear and put a fresh coat of it all over. Thank you.